Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Michael Romore from the City University of New York. Today, I'm here to talk to Christopher Ian Foster, author of Conscripts of Migration, Neoliberal Globalization, Nationalism, and the Literature of New African Diasporas, published in 2019 by the University Press of Mississippi. Conscripts of Migration offers a transnational and transoceanic study of the migratory literatures of the New African Diasporas in the context of contemporary crises and struggles over Global South migration. We'll explore how colonial histories produce and continue to produce such migrations and how migratory writers represent and defy these pressures. Additionally, we'll learn how the concept of migratory intervenes in multiple theoretical conversations in diaspora studies, certainly including Indian Ocean studies, but with wide interdisciplinary implications. Speaking from Tampa, Florida, I want to welcome Christopher Ian Foster to New Books in the Indian Ocean World. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book.
Thanks, Michael. I really appreciate it and honored to be here.
Totally. So, Ian, can you start us off by saying a few words about yourself? That is, you know, where you grew up, where you studied, how you became interested in your field, and any influential mentors and scholars along the way.
Of course. I'm originally from Washington State in the greater Pacific Northwest, and I did my undergraduate work at the University of Washington in Seattle, and I got a couple of bachelor's, one in anthropology and one in English literature. Then I moved to New York City, the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and received an interdisciplinary master's degree in liberal studies, and then went on to complete a PhD in the English department there. After that, I spent a few years as an assistant professor in a couple of different English departments, and now I'm in international studies at the Colorado State University, and I wanted to mention the sort of interdisciplinary nature of my study because I think it's going to come up later in my studies. I think it's going to come up later in the book. And just to mention a couple of mentors that were really important to me, particularly in grad school. The first is Robert Reed Farr, who was my dissertation director. He's at Harvard now, but I want to mention him because he introduced me to Black diaspora studies, which is so important and was so important to my area of interest. And he's at Harvard now. And then also in post-colonial studies, I wanted to mention Mina Alexander at the Graduate Center. She was a wonderful mentor for me there and a teacher and supported us, the students who were involved in post-colonial studies and thinking about things like phenomenology. And so I think I just want to mention those two as very important mentors, Robert Reed Farr and Mina Alexander.
Yeah, and as you know, they were both particularly influential for me as well.
I do.
Yeah. So let's turn to the book then. How did the idea for Conscripts of Migration develop? What was your research process like, and how did you experience the actual writing process?
Yes, it's a good question. So what I'd like to say is that the you can think about it as a larger project that essentially has two lives. One, the first life was as a dissertation, as a graduate student. So it started out as a product of years worth of research in graduate school, and it became a dissertation, which is its own genre and has scholarly aspects to it. And then it was rewritten and revised as a book. And what led me to sort of revising it and rewriting it was that although the dissertation as it existed was a solid work of scholarship and that sort of met the elements of that particular genre, it didn't really have an argument and it didn't really have a voice, and it was perhaps a given that it was in terms of a general audience, just a bit overly scholarly. And so I wanted to rewrite it in terms of an argument that I kind of finally came upon after I defended the dissertation. And I wanted to attempt to make it a little bit more widely accessible for a larger audience. And that is sort of tone down some of the scholarly characteristics of it. I don't think I went far enough on that. So perhaps that'll be something that I think about for the next project.
Well, even so, it seems like Conscripts of Migration is stunningly broad in its, at least in the implications of its argument. So it brings together multiple oceanic frameworks, including Mediterranean, Indian Ocean, and transatlantic migrations, in addition to numerous diasporic routes from global north to, from global south to global north across multiple languages and literary traditions. So I wondered if, given this breadth, you could say more about the methodological and theoretical context by which you bring these together. In other words, was there sort of an overarching methodological problem or dissatisfaction that the notion of migratude literature addresses?
Yes, it's a great question, and I appreciate the characterization of the book as broad. It is. There's a number of methodologies and theoretical concerns throughout, and I'll start with a sort of general answer, and then we can go from there. But I wanted to come back to this idea of interdisciplinarity, and I mentioned that a little bit in my bio. But it's important for me, it was important for me as I was writing it, to make sure that I'm drawing from different disciplines to approach the particular problem and subject matter at hand. So I'm sort of trying to pull from anthropology and sociology and economics, philosophy, of course, literature, which was the department that I was in, and politics. And within those sort of interdisciplinary concerns, there's another, there's quite a few sub-genres or fields, sub-fields that I work with. I mentioned post-colonial, global, and diaspora studies as being very, very important, but I also pull from Marxist methodologies, feminist methodologies, and I also mentioned phenomenology earlier. So those are some of the tools that I drew off of to try to approach the main concern of the book. And but the main concern of the book was really migration. Obviously it's right in the title, but human movement, but really to try to explain and to understand why our 21st century, which is characterized as the age of migration, we've seen more migrations and human movement than ever before in history. And so why is that migration characterized in terms of crisis and emergency? Why is it almost violent in nature? And so the question was really about immigration. And if we're not thinking about immigration in the way that we should, how should we, and how can we look at history and literature to help us understand the issues that sort of subtend the problems that we have now? And so that's the kind of, I guess, very, very general theme that ties together all of those fields and disciplines and concerns that you also mentioned. And so it's about immigration, but it's also an argument that there is a body of literature or cultural production, what have you, that actually goes far to give us a way to think about those concerns. And you mentioned migratude literature, and that's what we're calling it, or that's what I call it for short. I also use the term literature of new African diasporas. Migratude is more broad than African diasporas. There are South Asian migratudes, Caribbean migratudes. But the point is that this sort of body allows us, at least in for the book and the book's concern, allows us a sort of vehicle to think about this larger theme of immigration, and how do we think about it, and how do we solve the problems that we have now that are associated with it?
Yeah, so let's get into that history and literature by turning to the book and its chapters. So the book consists of 6 chapters. The first is titled Conscripts of Migration in the Era of Globalization. So what do you mean by describing migration in terms of conscription? Could you explain your use of this term and how it helps us approach the literature of the new African diaspora as you foreground in the book?
Yes. It's a great question, and it's sort of that term is sort of the cornerstone of the argument. And I admit that it's sort of controversial in the sense that the dictionary definition really has to do with forced conscription into an army. It has to do with power and force. And migration is something that we commonly think of as someone that one can do or not do, as free to do and free not to do. And so that there's sort of a counterintuitive nature. But before I get to that tension, I just want to sort of comment on a larger issue that I think the term wants to deal with. And the issue is that here in the United States and in the global North, we have a dominant sort of ideology, a dominant sort of understanding. And that's a sort of neoliberal ideology that really places primacy upon the individual, and particularly the individual in a free market. And it has to do with property and all that stuff. I won't get into that, but what we really have is this, again, primacy of the individual. And so when we think about immigration and migration, it's sort of automatically within those contexts, whether it's on the right or the left, whether we have discussions about immigrants that are demonizing and stereotyping and racializing, or whether we have discussions about immigrants on the other side in terms of tolerance and perhaps more compassionate language than on the right. What I wanted to get away from is that both of those actually rely on an idea that almost takes the individual out of context, and that prioritizes it for all sorts of different reasons that I won't get into now. But what conscription really does is a term that sort of mitigates against that. And what I'm arguing is that there, in terms of migration, there are a set of historical conditions that shape decisions to move or not move, that actually, if you think of forced migration or refugee crises or any other condition like that, it's really not about the individual or individual choice. It really is. There are individuals, but they are extant within a certain set of conditions that have been shaped by another certain set of historical conditions. And so on the one hand, conscription is a very, very general, almost metaphorical way of describing how one, particularly in the global South, exists in those conditions, and therefore is not free to move or not move, but is conscripted into a sort of, call it modernity or globalization, what have you, and that those conditions have their origin in imperialism historically. So there's a history there, and now we exist under a kind of neoliberal globalization or neocolonialism, and so there's a kind of set of conditions or contexts within which people move. And then the other side of conscription is that there's a much more material and immediate set of real and concrete situations and barriers that also conscript or shape those who move. And I'm thinking here in terms of the materiality of borders, in terms of walls or fences or cages, in terms of the materiality of documentation and discourses around documentation, like passports. We have a whole passport hierarchy. We have visas and papers and whatnot. And so there are very real material ways that folks are conscripted. And then finally add that to the sort of ideological or discursive, which is there's already a sort of preconceived script where immigrants fit in. And so I'm thinking there in terms of things like stereotypes, racialized stereotypes of migrants. So for example, we have this whole sort of demonizing rhetoric in the United States about people from Mexico being criminals or rapists and whatnot, a total myth with no bearing on reality. But it's this extant set of racist stereotypes that target immigrants. And that sort of discourse and rhetoric also has a colonial history, but it also sort of features a different kind of conscription. So for me, there's sort of conscription was a term that provided a hinge through which to look at immigration in multiple different ways that I thought were far better than what we have now, which is a kind of neoliberal individualist sort of a free movement or free not to move. If you moved for economic reasons, that's your fault or that's your country's fault. And all of the stuff that's sort of wrapped up in those sort of problematic yet dominant and sort of almost unconscious conceptions. So that's really where I want to kind of start in terms of thinking about conscription.
Yeah, it seems like your use of conscription and then also migratude is also turning against a certain like strand in post-colonial studies that identifies diaspora with a kind of elite cosmopolitanism. And that's something that you definitely pick up on in chapter two, titled Immigration and the Phenomenology of Movement from Negritude to Shalja Patel's Migratude. So this chapter traces the intellectual roots from Negritude era identity politics to the aesthetics of migratude found, for example, in Shalja Patel's eponymous work. So here you also engage with the philosophical tradition of phenomenology as a way of approaching migratude literature. Could you outline what the phenomenological method offers to theorizing the diasporic routes represented in literary works like Migratude?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I love phenomenology, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it too. But I think in order to sort of keep with the theme that we have here, I think that phenomenology is also a good tool to enter into questions about immigration that don't sort of rely on the neoliberal or liberalist or even nationalist conceptions of the individual and migration and all the sort of negative aspects of those things. So phenomenology actually wants us to get beyond that by looking at being itself. So of course it starts with Husserl and then goes various directions from Heidegger to Sartre. And now we have great work by people like Sarah Ahmed on queer phenomenology. Frantz Fanon, our hero in post-colonial studies, is actually doing phenomenology, sort of racial phenomenology in Black Skin, White Masks. So there's a whole history there, and there's a lot of wonderful work on it that folks are doing, including yourself. But without getting too much into that, I think that for me, that it was sort of in fitting with, I guess, the ethics of the book, where I really wanted to work against the flattening of subjects under what we could call neoliberal capital or neoliberal globalization that stereotype or flatten folks who move or individuals for various reasons, the reproduction of oppression, to demonize, to keep people out. All sorts of reasons to abdicate responsibility for the creation of those very migration crises in the global South. And so phenomenology actually does that by sort of bridging the gap between, I don't want to get too far into metaphysics and all of that stuff, but really what we can say that it gets to what Heidegger would kind of borrow from Husserl when he uses the term being in the world. which just means that a person is in the world and is shaped by the world in very complex ways. And phenomenology being a tool that gets us to a tool and a sort of ontology, that is a study of being, that gets us to this kind of being in the world. It uses what they call the natural attitude to cut through sort of preconceived ideas that are sort of presented as common sense, but are actually sort of mythical in a way, just like stereotypes and things like that. And so phenomenology I thought was a good tool to look at what was going on, immigration and the literature, but it was also something that I felt that these writers that I'm looking at were already doing. So in their novels and in their poems and in their plays, they were actually looking at migration and immigrants, not from a sort of individualist or a nationalist perspective, but from a way that really focused on the being in the world of the migrant, if we want to use that phrase, the being in the, and all of the objects that constellate that being, from borders and cages and checkpoints to just ideas of being in the world, ideas of what home is, what is diaspora, communities, and things like that. So for me, that's kind of the main reason that I thought phenomenology would be a good thing to go back to and look at in these terms.
Yeah, totally. And I think for me, one of the things you also gain from phenomenology is this sort of alternative engagement with humanism that's neither liberal nor colonial humanism. And I think that's exactly,
yes,
at least in part, where you go in chapter 3, right? Which is titled The Condition d'Immigré in Fatou Diom's The Belly of the Atlantic and the Aesthetics of Migration in the Francophone African Literary Tradition.
Too long of a title. Sorry about that.
No, you're good. Lots of information.
Yeah.
So this chapter extends the discussion of negritude from the previous chapter, this time in a Francophone context. Mm-hmm. So here you're connecting the immigrant condition represented in Fatou Diom's The Belly of the Atlantic as an engagement with negritude aesthetics, where the Black humanism of negritude informs a migrant humanism. So could you explain the development of and distinction between these humanisms in Diem's work, or perhaps more broadly?
Yeah, this is another wonderful question. It's also another pretty big question. And the answer I'm going to give, and I've been giving sort of reductive answers that sort of reduce, for example, the history and breadth of things like phenomenology and whatnot. But I want to try to answer the question in a way that engages listeners, and to sort of give a sense of I wouldn't even say an introduction to the history of these things, but maybe food for possible further research. And so really, and I like your question about liberal humanism as a response to the last answer. And I think it's good to start there and feel free to jump in, but so liberal humanism is something that started in Europe. It's something that starts burgeoning around in the Renaissance, Enlightenment sort of era, and it's a philosophy, but it's more than that. It's sort of a politics or a way of being and doing, and it was really a sort of a response against feudalism and just sort of the almost tyranny of religious divine right, and it wanted to focus instead on humans, obviously, and it gave us a lot of good philosophical and political material that you can work with from, you know, Kant onwards and before and after that. But the thing about it is that it was Eurocentric, and that almost maybe seems too obvious to mention, but that it was born in Europe, and although it claimed to deal with humanity and sort of almost a universal perspective, as cosmopolitanism does, what it was is fairly exclusive. It didn't consider other people in other parts of the world, in colonies, for example, in Africa or in South Asia, India, for example, as humans or as counting as human as Europeans. And so it's sort of a weirdly exclusive yet universalizing philosophy. And what you have in the sort of late colonial period, when you have anti-colonial movements, you mentioned the Negritude era, up through anti-colonial and post-colonial sort of philosophies or politics or activism, you have a sort of questioning of that Eurocentric notion of humanity that would exclude, that would on the surface claim to be a universal, but then would simply exclude others, particularly Black folks and non-white folks, people of color. And so what Negritude did, particularly Senghor, was to sort of prefer a sort of Black humanism is what he called it. It was sort of parallel to Pan-Africanism. But it was not only a sort of anti-racist and anti-colonial philosophy, but it was one that also attempted to revitalize an entire continent and an entire people that had been demonized through centuries of colonization. So once it also wanted to get away from these ideas of heart of darkness and places in the colonies as being backwards and things like that. So it was also a celebration of humans, and Senghor wanted to be specifically all humans. So he thought that there could be this mixture of European and African and South Asian, and it was almost sort of a multicultural philosophy there. He was also a phenomenologist in the sense that he used ontology, and he liked this idea of being in the world. There's been some criticism of Negritude, as you know, for being essentialist, and there were some regrettable phrases that he used that sort of almost kind of reified Africa and Europe. But if you really kind of do a deep dive into Negritude, you'll find that at the very most, we have a sort of strategic essentialism, and that there's more going on there than essentialism. But so that's in the colonial context. And then you have the period of, and I won't go into the history of it, but you have the post-colonial period, and then you have a period of intense economic exploitation by the global north that is driven by the what's called the Washington Consensus, which gives us basically global capitalism and neoliberal globalization as a new form of colonization, although very different in ways that it racializes and normativizes in different ways, very different ways of conquest and exploitation. And so what I think Migratude at large does, and Fatou Diome, does in Belly of the Atlantic is to really reveal those sort of problematic processes that are still sort of driven by a sort of almost universalist, I don't know if you want to say humanism, but still sort of driven by ideas that characterize so-called Western democracies about liberty and freedom and individuals and everybody mattering. And it kind of cuts through that myth and shows that discourse is and was just about as exclusive as Eurocentric notions of humanism. And though it's different from colonial humanism, you could say that it's been kind of refracted and changed and evolved in various ways. And so this idea of migrant humanism, so there's a specific kind of colonial racialization that has changed and shifted to now in the late 20th and 21st century, where you have a different, almost more variegated and wide-ranging racialization of immigrants, right? So it's still anti-Black and anti-brown, but it's evolved in a certain sense. And so a migrant humanism is really wanting to respond to that and sort of cut through this idea of a universalist, Eurocentric humanism as a way not only to sort of understand the sort of contemporary problems we have, but as a way to simply humanize the very beings of beings who move, who are still human now, that's migrants or refugees, but still continue to be dehumanized by the very Western liberal so-called democracies that we have now. And so it's very important what Fatou Diome and Migratude Riders do. It's very simple, but it's very important, is that sort of rehumanization of the migrant. And so that's kind of all what I mean by migrant humanism. But what I'm doing is I really see that it's coming out of these texts themselves. And I think just my interpretation of it is going to fall short. And so I'd encourage others to kind of get in there and see really what's going on. But I think that's actually coming from the literature and cultural production and philosophies that I'm looking at in the book.
Yeah, and it seems like that shift to migratude also like links these discourses, but also it links them beyond the transatlantic frame that nigritude sort of foregrounds, right? So for example, mm-hmm. East African sites, I think this is one of the sort of many overtures to Indian Ocean studies that the book makes. And that leads to chapter 4, We Carry Our Homes With Us, on the literature of the Somali Italian diasporas. So here you shift focus to Somali migrations to Italy since the 1980s. Could you say something about the historical factors that led to Somali Italian migration and how they're engaged in Afro-Italian migrant narratives?
Yes, I can. And it's a great question. And I wanted to pause, if I may, just for a second. You mentioned Indian Ocean Worlds. And I wanted to take a moment and maybe try to make an argument that the material here is indeed relevant to Indian Ocean Worlds. And I'd like to go back to one of the forefathers of Pan-Africanism in E.W. Blyden. And he's actually from the Caribbean, but after attempting to attend college in 1850 in the United States, but being denied based on his race, he spent the rest of his life in Liberia and would essentially inaugurate the field of Pan-Africanism. But the interesting thing is that his field, that his conception of Pan-Africanism also included the Indian Ocean world. And so if I could pause for a second and maybe just paraphrase a quote from him that he has in his book that he wrote in 1886, it'll include the Indian Ocean world, which I think migratude literature, as you mentioned, also includes. And so he's writing in 1886 and states that there has been an unbroken line of communication between the west coast of Africa through the Sudan and the so-called Great Desert and Asia from the time when portions of the descendants of Ham and remote Asias began their migrations westward and first saw the Atlantic Ocean. Africa is no vast island separated by an immense ocean from other portions of the globe and cut off through the ages from the men who have been influenced, who have made and influenced the destinies of mankind. She has, in just a couple more sentences, she's been closely connected both as a source and nourisher with some of the most potent influences which have affected for good the history of the world. The people of Asia and the people of Africa have been in constant intercourse. And so really what he's saying is that there is there's been this constant movement essentially for Blyden from biblical times among people and ideas across the Indian Ocean world, from India to Africa to Sudan to the Mediterranean world and then to the Atlantic. And so it's kind of interesting. I think there's an echo of that sort of pan, what I don't know what you'd call it, trans or pan-oceanic, that would connect the Atlantic, it would connect the Indian Ocean world to the Mediterranean and even the Caribbean, as he's from there, that is sort of echoed in migratude literature, particularly if you look at folks like Shalja Patel and on the east coast of Africa. But so that's that. And feel free to jump in with your comments on that. But I just wanted to tie back into the Indian Ocean world. In terms of...
That's great. Yeah. And I think it really underscores how Pan-Africanism was always, at least in part, an Afro-Asian discourse, even though sometimes that gets obscured.
Yes, and there's been a flowering of great work recently in the past decade that's connecting these worlds, yourself included, that I think is so important to sort of take us beyond and through and outside the Black Atlantic, which is still super important to consider. But folks like Lisa Lowe's Intimacy of Four Continents, for example, is going to make sure that she connects the Indian Ocean to the Black Atlantic and the Caribbean and the New World. And folks working on Caribbean indenture are connecting that and all sorts of good work on that. And I know that you're working on that, so that's great. Now, I've totally ignored your question about the historical context of Italy. So I just want to run through that really quick for our readers. Cool. So that you get a sense of just the massive amounts of outside incursion into this one particular colony, Somalia, and how, of course, that's going to go and create crises that then will lead to immigration crises, migration crises, and refugee crises even. And so if you look at Somalia, for example, it's an Italian colony from 1888 to 1941. It's then a British colony from 1941 to 1960. From 69 to 91, you have the dictator Siad Barre. And during that period, you also have the Cold War, where you have neocolonial powers, the United States and Russia, really is a form of neocolonial. There was all sorts of puppeteering around the world to devastating effects. For example, you had a war in 1977 between Ethiopia and Somalia, and on the surface, it was about Ogaden and whether Ethiopia had colonized that or not. But really what it was is a war. It was a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia at the time, the USSR, right? And there was massive amounts of funds for both dictators, massive amounts of armaments, and at one point, U.S. and Russia would switch sides to devastating effects, and it created this war that would kill 2.5 million people. And so, this is a significant amount of the responsibility lies with the two superpowers there. And then after that, you have. After the Washington Consensus, and you have the turn to neoliberal globalization, which I just call neocolonialism, from 81 to 89, you have the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and everybody getting into colonies. But in Somalia specifically, IMF forces Somalia to devalue currency 460%, to liberalize its economy, to privatize public services. And one of what's also a part of what's called structural adjustment programs, which were imposed on former colonies all throughout the global South, or were austerity programs, which was just a nice way of saying you're going to cut public spending to pay us back. And on the eve of the Civil War, it was transferring nearly 50% of its export earnings to debtors. So it's paying back its former colonial masters for what? The right to live, to be. It's paying back the institutions of economic globalization. And so that creates, among other historical moments and happenings and contexts, the Civil War, which is devastating. It creates refugee crisis. It creates the failed state. And the state basically collapses. And so you have, again, just waves of refugee crises, migration, people having to move. And so, you know, to think about it in a sort of neoliberal way where an individual has the choice or has a freedom of movement, it seems really ridiculous in this context. And it seems better to look at it through conscription, in the sense you have this kind of very real material historical conscription, and then you have factors in the present day. And so on top of that, Somalia is then sort of demonized or mythologized as this failed state where it's just bad Somali actors, Somali people failed, and so we're going to blame that on them. And because it's a failed state, it becomes a site of terrorism. And so you have this shifting of blame away from the global north, away from the United States, away from any of the former colonial masters, onto individual Somali folks and the Somali failed Somali state. And so and this is just one colony that we're talking about, but if you look at these histories, it just shows how material these conditions are and how relevant they are in terms of understanding immigration and migration crises, including refugee crises, which is a different category, but related. And so if you read some of these novels that I look at here, the Christina Ali Farah novel, for example, or the Nadifa Muhammad, you do get a sense of that historical context as a way to sort of look at what we need to think about in terms of human movement now, immigration crises now, what's going on. It is related to the United States. It is related to powers in the global north, and sort of the world is sort of connected in this asymmetrical whole, and there's a historical precedent for it. And I think the literature that I'm looking at, or cultural production in general, really speaks to that.
Yeah, and another important topic that is definitely engaged throughout, but then it's taken up more specifically in chapter 5, concerns the gendered nature of conscripted migration. So chapter 5 is titled A Matter of Timing: Queer Diasporas and Heteronationalism in Duryea Özman's Fairy Tales for Lost Children. So this chapter turns to the intersection of migration and sexuality. Why is attending to this intersection so important, and how does Özman's Fairy Tales for Lost Children intervene?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you can sort of see how almost wildly different the methodologies and theories and subject matter is in the book. I think it's all connected, but you know, it might seem sort of counterintuitive to say that, to kind of argue that sexuality and immigration are related or even connected. What does one have to do with the other, for example? But if you look at a couple of the recent really important critical lenses and fields, which I think are important now in terms of both queer theory and critical race theory, which I hear is being banned now. So we'll hope that doesn't happen.
Right.
What that tells us is that race and sex and sexuality are normative. And what does that mean? It means the way that society not only thinks about or conceptualizes race or sexuality or migration is both a sort of construct that exists as a discourse, and that is based on a normative one, which presupposes that there's an abnormal, there's something that's not normative, there's something that's not normal, and that needs to be excluded or policed. And this idea that these normative categories, such as race or sexuality, or whether one is a migrant or a refugee or a native or a citizen, those are actually policed in real life or in material reality, just in the sense that there are material practices based around policing those things. There are laws based around that. For example, there was a law in 1952 that actually outlawed anyone who was gay or lesbian from immigrating to the United States. And you'll also know that, of course, we have laws that outlaw certain kinds of immigrants and all of that stuff. So it's both migration, sexuality, race, they are managed monitored and policed. And so when you think about that sort of larger systemic structure or question, then you can begin to connect sexuality and migration, because they're both normative and they're both managed in certain ways to very real effects. And the wonderful thing about Derya Osman's collection of short stories, Fairy Tales for Lost Children, it's just an awesome collection. And he's a awesome queer artist, and he's also a philosopher. If you read his interviews, he just gives wonderful interviews. But he's a queer Somali Kenyan British man living in London now. And so he is intersecting all of these different normativities from almost sort of patriarchal and homophobic religious aspects in Somalia or Kenya to heteronormativity in London, to racialization in London, to colonial histories and migrants and various diasporas. And so it's this really incisive intersection of all of these issues that have to do with identity and the managing of movement and the managing of sexuality and the policing of these various things. And I think it's just a wonderful work that is wide ranging, and it's a lot more than what I've described as well. Those are just the kind of issues that I'm focusing on, because I think it gets to the point of the book, which is to think about how we can better understand immigration. But it's just a wonderful book that actually talks to all those issues, and then kind of shows us that indeed this idea of sexuality as intersecting with migration isn't as counterintuitive as we might have thought.
Cool. And then last but not least, chapter 6 on the imperial origins of immigration in Nadifa Muhammad's Black Mamba Boy and Claude McKay's Banjo, I think brings together a lot of these strands. So how do Muhammad's Black Mamba Boy, a novel of migration across the Horn of Africa, and Banjo, McKay's noted Pan-African novel set in 1930s Paris, connect in your readings?
Yes, and this is another wonderful set of novels. I just love all of these novels. So for our readers, go out and read all those. I know you have, Michael, but if you haven't, check them out. So Claude McKay's novel Banjo came out in 1929, and Claude McKay is actually Jamaican. But lived in the United States for a long time, and then kind of globetrotted around, lived in Paris and also in Africa, and he went to Russia. But Banjo was written in 1929, and it's this wonderfully Pan-African novel. And it does have echoes of the kind of Pan-Africanism that Blyden showed us earlier, in this connection of Indian Ocean worlds, Europe, Africa, Atlantic worlds. And you'll just have to read it to kind of get a sense of that wonderful sort of transoceanic, transnational, and just diasporic sense of it. And he calls it a vagabondage. So you get a sense of this non-elite kind of almost what I will come to call migratude later, sort of non-elite sort of migration that most of the world's travelers are faced with. But McKay's novel is wonderfully Pan-Africanist and connects to all these issues, and is certainly interesting to Indian Ocean worlds in the sense that there's a South Asian character who is in Marseille in France, and a part of the what he calls the Black Beach Boys. And so there's really a lot that you can do there with Indian Ocean worlds and its connection to Pan-Africanism and all this other stuff. But what's really interesting is that Black Mamba Boy, which was published by Nadifa Muhammad, and she's a Somali-British writer, it's published in 2010, so it's quite a bit later than the McKay novel. But not only does she actually sort of almost meta-fictively, I guess, if we can still even use that term, but she actually, at the end of her novel, integrates some of McKay's characters into her novel, which is about a little Somali boy during the colonial context and towards the end of it in World War II, who's he starts out in Yemen, and then he's migrating and traveling, and he peregrinates all over East Africa, the Horn of Africa, North Africa, and it takes us to London, and we have a stop in Palestine even. And she also, like other migratude texts, really wants to make sure that we understand that the way that immigration is structured today does have imperial histories. And so she's very clear on showing us, as Jama, who is the protagonist's name, travels around different places in Africa and the Middle East, etc. Mostly it's in Africa, but there's all of these sort of imposed colonial, what you could almost call immigration regimes. So she's talking about borders and checkpoints and cages in terms of jailing people who cross different colonies and colonial powers. So it's almost this European structure was sort of dropped onto Africa to very violent effects. So that those two novels really kind of speak to. I mean, you could almost go back to the migrant humanism that I was talking about earlier, and suggest that there's a sort of migrant humanism that exists in McKay's Banjo, and that would appear again in Guillaume's novel, and appear yet again in Black Mamba Boy. But just as a sort of way of being in the world, or an ethics that not only exposes the sort of racialized terror of immigration regimes, but would recuperate or highlight migrants, vagabonds, refugees, and diasporic populations. And those also have a colonial history, as Edward Said points out in Culture and Imperialism. But those are just, I'll just close by saying those are two wonderful books that I think speak to exactly the themes that we're talking about today.
Totally. So thanks for walking us through the book. Before we move to our closing question, could you just take some time to read a favorite passage from the book?
Yeah, sure. So I'm going to read the entire book because all of the passages are great. No, I'm just kidding. It's a great question, and I wanted to pause on actually in the introduction. There's a quote by Quinn Slobodian, who is a great critic of neoliberal capitalism and neoliberalism. And what he's talking about is in the 70s and 80s, the imposition of what we would call now neoliberal globalization, neoliberal capitalism, and just how devastating it was. And we've run through some issues in the podcast, so I won't go back over that. But the quote is, in response to the sort of neoliberal or the global north sort of squashing of what was the new international economic order in the 70s, which would have been something like a trade union of the global south, sort of like a post-colonial union. So that was immediately squashed by the powers that be, from the IMF to the global to the World Bank and the WTO. The Washington Consensus and the Vocal Shock and all of that stuff, which I won't get too much into. But so he notes this, and it's very telling. And the reason why I wanted to read this, because it's sort of telling about our contemporary situation here in 2020, 21, and beyond. And he says that, and this is a quote, "Given the patent refusal of the global north to live up to its own liberal principles by practicing actual free trade in key sectors such as agriculture, further deviations from the liberal principles themselves were necessary to account for path-dependent inequality." And so I go on to explain that quote. And so what I say is, in a sense, post-colonial immigration is a symptom of the liberal northern countries' fascist policies in the South, and therefore migrants cannot be welcomed as such, for the truth of their policies, these fascist policies imposed upon the South, inscribed upon the bodies and memories of the dislocated, would undermine the very narratives upon which the nations of the civilized world were built, quote unquote. And so with that, what I meant there is not really a controversial point. It's that imperial nations in what has been called the Western world, living under quote unquote liberal democracies, have imposed fascist policies on their colonies. Now, you only need to take a brief look at history to find out how that's true. For example, look at Britain's concentration camp in Kenya in the 1950s, or the constant practice of the U.S. to overthrow democratically elected leaders in Latin America and elsewhere. So there are fascist policies being imposed and utilized abroad, where principles of liberal democracy, freedom, and things like that are championed at home. The reason why I wanted to bring up this quote or this little passage was because, and I wasn't thinking this when I wrote it at all. It was just a critique of imperialism abroad or neocolonialism abroad. But it gets to the question of fascism coming home to roost. And so what we have right now is a sort of burgeoning move towards a right-wing dictatorship in the United States and in various other places. Populism has taken hold, bigoted nationalism, and all of this stuff. And so I think a lot of folks that might not have been aware of it, say 5 years ago, are waking up and kind of startled to kind of sense some fascistic policies at home here in the global North, in the US, and to wonder, well, what's happening and how did we get there and how the heck do we solve these problems? And I think one thing that you can do is look to the historical fact that the United States and other countries have actually used those very policies and practices and discourses on other places in the global South, whether it's their actual colonies or post-colonies, and look at the history of that and how the colonized have dealt with that, how the post-colonized have dealt with that, because certainly they were not allowed to vote out the colonized. They had to resist in other ways. And so what it does, I think the book is sort of, even though it's not really about fascism in America at all, I think it's relevant in the sense that we can look to places in the global South that have experienced that. And of course, some of those experiences lead to the creation of migration and refugee crisis. So it's also relevant to immigration. But it's interesting to those who might want to go and ask about what's happening in the global North now and how we can look to the global South and to histories of the global South in places that span, for example, the Indian Ocean world, the Black Atlantic world, Mediterranean, crises in the Mediterranean and whatnot. So that's why I wanted to read that passage and really more of a discussion, sort of almost question to end with, than in any real answers from me on that.
Yeah, totally. And that just underscores the breadth of the book and the works under study.
Thank you.
Ian, we've taken a lot of your time. So in closing, let me just ask, what are you working on now? And can you tell us about your current and future projects or what you hope to work on?
Yeah, thanks for that. I'd love to. I'll try to be brief, but so I've got an article coming out that is sort of related, but it's about sort of neoliberal neo-colonization, and it uses refugee crises in Haiti and Palestine as a way to look at that. That's coming out in Journal of Narrative Theory in a couple months, and I really like it because I actually start out with this Dead Kennedys song. It's a punk rock band from the 1980s, Dead Kennedys song. They have a song called The Great Wall, which is actually really relevant. And I start out with that, but Jella Biafra actually talks about global apartheid there. So I kind of do a riff on that. I've got a couple of articles like that, but the next project is going to be sort of similar to the issues that I just brought up, that passage looks at. And it's really a move towards looking at the global effects of American empire from 1900 to now, And not only how that creates all sorts of different things, in including migration and refugee crisis, and how it can explain what's happening now in the United States, but it really looks at responses from the global South, Latin America, Caribbean, Africa, South Asia, and other places that have been in various ways affected by American imperialism that still is happening now, as we know. And so the book kind of shifts a little bit more towards American imperialism. And I think it shifts a little bit away from literature. It'll still include that, but it'll just kind of be, it'll just look at sort of various global responses to American empire. And then, of course, what those responses tell us about how we can solve what you would call problems at what you would call home if you're here in the United States. And those problems are of course, not only felt by people here, and have actually always been felt by certain populations here, including Black populations, who, Stokely Carmichael rightly said 50 years ago, are sort of like colonized populations in the United States, but affects elsewhere. Certainly, we saw that the 2008 financial crisis was global and not just unique to Washington. So, hoping that'll tell us, looking to have a sort of global approach, will help us solve some of these problems. But that's a very, very sort of early idea. It's unformed and it's still sort of forming. But that's sort of the direction I'm interested in going.
Yeah, those sound great. Thanks, Ian. And thank you for listening to today's episode, in which we explored conscripts of migration, neoliberal globalization, nationalisms, and the literature of new African diasporas, published in 2019 by the University Press of Mississippi. This is your host, Michael Remore. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.